13. "Thank heaven," a voice was saying, slowly and methodically, a woman's crisp voice. "We're back. We're back in the real world." The pools of gloom were gone. The familiar scene of forest and ocean lay spread out everywhere. The green expanse of Big Sur Park and the ribbon of highway at the foot of Cone Peak had seeped back into existence. Overhead hung the crisp blue sky of afternoon. The California golden poppies sparkled in the autumn moisture. There lay the picnic spread, the jars and dishes and paper plates and cups. To Hamilton's right rose the cool grove of evergreens. The Ford coupe, bright and shiny, glinted in a friendly metallic way from where he had parked it, not far off, at the end of the meadow. A seagull flapped through the haze gathered along the horizon. A diesel truck rumbled noisily along the highway, trailing clouds of black smoke. In the dry shrubbery halfway down the slope, a ground squirrel zigzagged toward his crumbling dirt burrow. On all sides of Hamilton, the others were stirring. They were seven in all. Bill Laws was somewhere at San Jose, lamenting the loss of his soap factory. Through a pain-racked blur, Hamilton could make out the form of his wife. Marcia had risen shakily to her knees and was gazing blankly around her. Not far off was the still inert Edith Pritchett. Beyond were Arthur Sylvester and David Pritchett. At the edge of the picnic spread, Charlie McFaith had begun to feebly twitch. Close by Hamilton sat the trim, sparse figure of Joan Rice. Methodically, the woman was gathering together her purse and glasses. Her face was almost expressionless as she circumspectly patted her tight bun of hair.
"Thank heaven," she repeated, climbing skillfully to her feet. "That's over."
It was her voice that had aroused him. McFaith, from where he lay, gazed at her vacantly, his face blank with shock.
"Back,"
he echoed without comprehension.
"We're back in the real world,"
Miss Rice said in a matter-of-fact voice.
"Isn't that wonderful?"
To the large, unmoving shape stretched out in the moist grass beside her, she said,
"Get up, Mrs. Pritchett. You don't have any hold over us now."
Bending over, she pinched the woman's great bloated arm.
"Everything's the way it used to be."
"Thank God,"
Arthur Sylvester muttered piteously as he struggled to get up.
"Oh, God, that awful voice!"
"Is it over?"
Marcia breathed, her brown eyes misty with doubt and relief. Shuddering, she tottered up and stood swaying.
"That awful nightmare at the end. I only caught a glimpse of it."
"What was it?"
David Pritchett pleaded, trembling with fright.
"That place and that voice talking to us."
"It's gone,"
McFaith said weakly, with prayerful avidity.
"We're safe."
"I'll help you up, Mr. Hamilton,"
Miss Rice said, approaching him. Extending her slender, bony hand, she stood smiling her pale, colorless smile.
"How does it feel to be back in the real world?"
He could say nothing. He could only lie, petrified with terror.
"Come now,"
Miss Rice said calmly.
"You're going to have to get up sooner or later."
Pointing to the Ford, she explained,
"I want you to drive us back to Belmont. The sooner everybody is back home safe and sound, the happier I'll be."
Sharp-faced, without a trace of sentiment, she added,
"I want to see you all back the way you were, back where you belong. I won't be satisfied until then."
His driving, like everything else, was mechanical, rigid, a thing done reflexively, without volition. Ahead of them, the state highway spread out, smooth and carefully tended, between the rolling gray hills. Now and then, other cars passed them. They were nearing Bayshore Freeway.
"It won't be long,"
Miss Rice said with anticipation.
"We're almost back to Belmont."
"Listen," Hamilton said hoarsely. "Stop pretending. Stop playing the sadistic game."
"What game is that?"
Miss Rice inquired mildly.
"I don't follow you, Mr. Hamilton."
"We're not back in the real world. We're in your world. Your paranoiac, vicious..."
"But I've created the real world for you,"
Miss Rice said simply.
"Don't you see? Look around you. Haven't I done a good job? It was all planned out in advance, a long time ago. You'll find everything as it should be. I haven't overlooked anything."
His hands white as they gripped the steering wheel, Hamilton demanded,
"You were waiting? You knew it would come around to you after Mrs. Pritchett?"
"Of course."
Quietly, with controlled pride, Miss Rice explained,
"You just haven't used your head, Mr. Hamilton. Remember why Arthur Sylvester had control first, before any of the rest of us? Because he never lost consciousness. And why did Edith Pritchett follow him? She was stirring,
Marcia said, stricken.
There, on the floor of the Bevatron, we could see her at night when we dreamed. You should have paid more attention to your dreams, Mrs. Hamilton,
Miss Rice observed.
You could have looked down the line and seen who lay ahead. After Mrs. Pritchett, I was the closest to consciousness.
And after you? Hamilton demanded.
It doesn't matter what comes after me, Mr. Hamilton, because I'm the last. You're back. You've come to the end of your trip. Here's your little world. Isn't it lovely? And it belongs to all of you. That's why I created it, so you'd have things as you wanted them. You'll find everything intact. I hope you'll begin living as you were before. I guess,
Marcia said presently,
we'll have to. We don't have any other choice.
Why don't you let us go?
McFaith demanded futilely.
I can't let you go, Mr. McFaith,
Miss Rice answered.
I'd have to stop existing to do that.
Not completely,
McFaith pointed out in an eager, stuttering voice.
You could let us use something on you. That chloroform, something to knock you out, something to...
Mr. McFaith,
Miss Rice interrupted calmly.
I've worked very hard on this. I've been planning it for a long time since the accident of the Bevatron, since I first found out that my turn would come. Wouldn't it be a shame to let all this go to waste? We may never have another chance. No, this is too valuable an opportunity to miss. Much too valuable.
After a while, David Pritchett pointed and said,
There's Belmont!
It'll be nice to be back,
Edith Pritchett said in a wavering, uncertain voice.
It's such a sweet little town.
One by one, under Miss Rice's directions, Hamilton let them off at their homes. The last were himself and Marcia. The two of them sat in the parked coupe in front of Miss Rice's apartment house as Miss Rice collected her things and climbed nimbly out onto the sidewalk.
You go on home,
she told them helpfully.
A hot bath and then bed would be the best thing in the world for you.
Thanks,
Marcia said, almost inaudibly.
Try to relax and enjoy yourselves,
Miss Rice instructed.
And please, try to forget all the things that have happened. They're behind you now. Try to remember that.
Yes,
Marcia repeated, mechanically responding to the dry, dispassionate schoolteacher tone.
We'll remember.
As she crossed the sidewalk toward the apartment house steps, Miss Rice paused a moment. Her long corduroy coat pulled around her, she was an unimposing, not particularly striking figure. With her armload of purse, gloves, and a copy of The New Yorker she had picked up at a drugstore, she might have been any middle-class secretary returning home from a day at the office. The cold wind of evening ruffled her sand-colored hair. Behind her horn-rimmed glasses, her eyes were enlarged and distorted as she gazed perceptively at the two people in the car.
Maybe I'll drop over and visit you in a few days,
she said tentatively.
We might have a quiet evening, just sitting and chatting.
That would be fine,
Marcia managed.
Good night,
Miss Rice said, concluding the matter. With a brisk nod, she turned and tripped up the stairs, unlocked the massive front door, and disappeared into the dim, carpeted lobby of her apartment building.
Get us home,
Marcia said in a low, jangling voice.
Jack, get us home. Please, get us home.
He did, as quickly as possible. Bouncing the coupe up into their driveway, he yanked on the parking brake, snapped off the motor, and savagely kicked open the door.
Here we are,
he told her. Marcia sat beside him, unmoving, her skin as pale and cold as wax. Gently but firmly, he took hold of her and lifted her from the car. Picking her up in his arms, he strode along the path, around the side of the house and onto the front porch.
Anyhow,
Marcia said shakily,
Ninny Numcat will be back. And Sex, that's back too. Everything will be back, won't it? Won't this be just as good?
He said nothing. Busily, he concentrated on getting the front door open.
She wants power over us,
Marcia went on.
But that's all right, isn't it? We have our world. She did create the real world for us. It looks the same to me. Do you see any difference? Jack, for God's sake, say something.
With his shoulder, he pushed the door aside and shoved on the living room light.
We're home,
Marcia said, glancing timidly around as he set her unceremoniously on her feet.
Yes, we are.
He slammed the door behind them.
It's our old place, isn't it?
just like it used to be before this all started.
Starting to unbutton her coat, Marcia paced around their living room, examining the drapes, the books, the prints on the walls, the furnishings.
It feels good, doesn't it? Such a relief. All the familiar things. Nobody dropping snakes on us. Nobody abolishing categories. Isn't it fine?
It's sensational, Hamilton said bitterly.
Jack.
She came up quietly beside him, her coat over her arm.
We can't put anything over on her, can we? It won't be like Mrs. Pritchett. She's too smart. She's a long way ahead of us.
A million years ahead of us, he agreed. She had all this planned out, thinking, meditating, plotting, scheming, waiting for her chance to get control of us.
In his pocket was a hard round cylinder. With a furious jerk, he yanked it out and hurled it across the room against the wall. The empty bottle of chloroform bounced against the rug, rolled a short distance, and came silently to rest, unbroken.
That won't do any good here, he said. We might as well give up. This time we really are licked.
From the closet, Marcia got a hanger and began pulling her coat around it.
Your Laws is going to feel bad.
He ought to slaughter me.
No,
Marcia disagreed.
It isn't your fault.
How can I look him in the face? How can I look any of you in the face? You wanted to stay back in Edith Pritchett's world. I brought you here. I fell for that psychotic strategy.
Don't worry about it, Jack. It won't do any good.
No, he admitted. It won't do any good.
I'll fix us some hot coffee.
At the kitchen door, Marcia turned wanly.
You want brandy in yours?
Sure. Swell.
With a forced smile, Marcia disappeared into the kitchen. For an interval, there was silence. Then her screams began. Hamilton was on his feet in an instant. Sprinting down the hall, he emerged at the doorway of the kitchen. At first, he failed to see it. Marcia, leaning against the kitchen table, partly blocked his view. It was as he moved forward to grab hold of her that he saw it. The scene imprinted itself on his brain, and then cut off as he closed his eyes and dragged his wife away. One hand over her mouth, he stood forcing back her moaning screams, trying not to join with her, trying with all his will to control his own emotions.
Miss Rice had never liked cats.
She had been afraid of cats. Cats were her enemies. The thing on the floor was Ninny Numbcat. He had been turned inside out. But he was still alive. The tangled mess was a still-functioning organism. Miss Rice had seen to that. She was not going to let the animal get away. Quivering, palpitating, the moistly shining blob of bones and tissue was undulating sightlessly across the kitchen floor. Its slow, steady progress had been going on for some time, probably since Miss Rice's world had come into existence. The grotesque mass, in 3.5 hours, had managed to drag itself in a kind of peristaltic wave halfway across the kitchen.
"It can't," Marcia wailed. "It can't be alive."
Getting a shovel from the backyard, Hamilton scooped the mess up and carried it outside. Praying that it could be killed, he filled a zinc bucket with water and slid the quivering heap of organs, bones, and tissue into it. For a time, the remnants lay half-swimming, oozing, and clinging, seeking to find some way out of the bucket. Then, gradually, with a final shudder of animation, the thing sank under and died. He burned the remains, dug a hasty grave, and buried it. Washing his hands and putting away the shovel, he returned to the house. It had taken only a few minutes. It seemed longer. Marcia was sitting quietly in the living room, her hands pressed together, gazing steadily ahead of her. She didn't look up as he entered the room.
"Darling," he said.
"Is it over?"
"All over. He's dead. You can be glad of that. She can't do anything more to him."
"I envy him. She hasn't even begun on us."
"But she hated cats. She doesn't hate us."
Marcia turned slightly.
"Remember what you said to her that night? You scared her. And she remembers it."
"Yes," he admitted. "She probably does. She probably doesn't forget anything."
Returning to the kitchen, he began fixing the coffee. He was pouring it into the cups when Marcia came quietly in and began getting out the cream and sugar.
"Well?"
she said.
"That's our answer."
"To what question?"
"To the question, can we live?" "The answer is no. Worse than no."
"There's nothing worse than no,"
he said. But even to his own ears, his voice lacked conviction.
She's insane, isn't she?
Apparently. A paranoiac with delusions of conspiracy and persecution. Everything she sees has some significance. Part of the plot directed against her.
And now,
Marcia said,
she doesn't have to worry, because for the first time in her life she's in a position to combat it.
As he sipped the scalding black coffee, Hamilton said, I think she really believes this is a replica of the real world. Of her real world, at least. Good God, her real world will be so far beyond any of the fantasies of the rest of us. He was silent a moment and then finished. That thing she made Ninny into. She probably imagines that's what we would do to her. She probably thinks that goes on all the time. Getting to his feet, Hamilton began moving around the house, pulling down the blinds. It was evening. The sun had sunk into oblivion. Outside the house, the streets were dark and chill. From the locked desk drawer, he got his .45 caliber automatic and began fitting shells into the chamber. Just because she runs this world, he said to his tensely watching wife, doesn't mean she's omnipotent. He pushed the gun away in his inside coat pocket. There it made a lumpy, conspicuous bulge. Marcia smiled wanly.
You look like a criminal.
I'm a private eye.
Where's your bosomy secretary?
That's you, Hamilton said, smiling back at her. Self-consciously, Marcia raised her hands.
I wondered if you'd notice that I'm back again.
I do notice.
Is it all right?
She asked shyly. I'm willing to tolerate you, for old time's sake.
Such a strange thing. I feel almost gross.
So sort of
non-aesthetic.
Lips pressed tight together, she wandered around in a little circle.
Don't you think I'll get used to it again? But it does feel odd. I must still be under Edith Pritchett's influence.
Ironically, Hamilton said, that was the last place. We're on a different treadmill now. In her shy pleasure, Marcia chose not to hear him.
Let's go downstairs, Jack. Down in the audiophile room, where we can sort of relax and listen to music.
Coming toward him, she lifted her small hands to his shoulders.
Can we, please?
Pulling roughly away, he said, some other time. Dismayed, Marcia stood hurt and surprised.
What's the matter?
You don't remember?
Oh.
She nodded.
That girl, that waitress. She disappeared, didn't she? While you and she were down there.
She wasn't a waitress.
I guess not.
Marcia brightened.
Anyhow, she's back now, so it's all right, isn't it? And?
She gazed hopefully up into his face.
I don't mind about her, I understand.
He wasn't sure whether to be annoyed or amused.
You understand about what?
How you felt. I mean, it didn't really have anything to do with her. She was just a way for you to assert yourself. You were protesting.
Putting his arms around her, he pulled her close to him.
You're an incredibly broad-minded person.
I believe in looking at things in a modern way,
Marcia said stoutly.
Glad to hear it.
Disengaging herself, Marcia tugged coaxingly at his shirt collar.
Could we? You haven't played records for me in months. Not like you used to. I was so jealous when you two went down there. I'd like to hear some of our old favorites.
You mean Tchaikovsky? That's what you usually want when you talk about our old favorite.
Go turn on the light in the heater. Get it all nice, all lit up and inviting. So it'll be that way when I come down.
Bending forward, he kissed her on the mouth.
I'll have it radiating eroticism.
Marcia wrinkled her nose at him.
You scientist.
The stairs were dark and cold. Feeling his way with care, Hamilton descended into the gloom one step at a time. A measure of good feeling returned to him, brought by the familiar routine of love. Soundlessly humming to himself, he advanced farther into the shadowy depths of the basement, making his way with the automatic reflex of long experience. Something coarse and slimy brushed his leg and stuck there, a heavy, ropey strand, sticky with damp ooze. Violently, he jerked his leg away, and beneath him, at the bottom of the steps, something hairy and ponderous scuttled off into the audiophile room and became still. Not moving his body, Hamilton clung to the wall of the stairwell. Extending his arm, He groped for the light switch below. His probing fingers touched it. With a sweeping surge, he flicked it on and straightened himself out. The light winked fitfully into existence, a sputtering yellow puddle in the murkiness. Across the basement stairs hung a crude bundle of strand, some of them broken, many of them wound together in a shapeless cable of gray. A web, a clumsy and brutal job of spinning, done hurriedly, without finesse, by something immense and squat and bestial. Underfoot, the steps were coated with dust. The ceiling was stained with vast streaks of filth, as if the web spinner had crawled and crept everywhere, exploring each corner and crack. Drained of strength, Hamilton sank down on the step. He could sense her there, below him, waiting in the audiophile room in the fetid darkness. He had, by blundering into her half-completed web, frightened her off. The web was not strong enough to hold him. He was still free to struggle, to pull himself loose. He did so, slowly, with painstaking care, disturbing the web as little as possible. The strands came away and his leg was free. His trouser was coated with a thick blob of gummy substance, as if a giant slug had squirmed across him. Shuddering, Hamilton grasped the railing and began to climb back upstairs. He had gone only 2 steps when his legs, of their own volition, refused to carry him farther. His body comprehended what his mind refused to accept. He was going back down, down, toward the audiophile room. Dazed, terrified, he spun around and scrambled in the opposite direction, and again the monstrous thing happened. The ragged, clinging nightmare. Still, he was going down. Beneath him, the dark shadows stretched out, the strewn filth and debris. He was trapped. As he crouched, staring in hypnotized fascination at the descent below him, there was a sound. Above and behind him, at the top of the stairs, Marcia had appeared. "Jack," she called hesitantly. "Don't come down," he snarled, turning his head slightly, until he could dimly make out the illuminated shape of her body. "Keep off the stairs!"
"But
stay where you are!" Breathing heavily, he clung to the step, his fingers wrapped tightly around the railing, trying to collect his wits. He had to proceed slowly. He had to keep from leaping up and scrambling mindlessly toward the bright doorway above him and the slender image of his wife.
"Tell me what it is,"
Marcia said sharply.
"I can't."
"Tell me or I'll come down."
She meant it. The decision was there in her voice.
"Darling," he said huskily, "I can't seem to get back upstairs."
"Are you hurt? Did you fall?"
"I'm not hurt. Something's happened. When I try to come back up..."
He took a deep, shuddering breath.
"I find myself going down."
"Is there anything I can do? Won't you turn toward me? Must you have your back to me?"
Hamilton laughed wildly.
"Sure I'll turn toward you."
Gripping the railing, he made a cautious about-face, and found himself still facing the gloomy cave of dust and shadows.
"Please,"
Marcia begged,
"please turn and look at me."
Anger surged up in him, impotent fury that could not be expressed. With a baffled curse, he slid to his feet.
"The hell with you," he snapped. "The hell with—"
From a long way off came the peal of the door chime.
"Somebody's at the door,"
Marcia said frantically.
"Well, go let them in."
He was past caring. He had given up. For a moment, Marcia struggled. Then, with a swirl of her skirt, she was gone. The hall light flooded starkly down behind him, casting a long, foreboding shadow into the stairwell. His own shadow, elongated and immense.
"Good God,"
a voice said, a man's voice.
"What are you doing down there, Jack?"
Peering over his shoulder, he made out the grim, upright figure of Bill Laws.
"Help me,"
Hamilton said quietly.
"Certainly."
Promptly, Laws turned to Marcia, who had come up beside him.
"Stay up here,"
he ordered her.
"Hold on to something so you won't fall."
Grabbing her hand, he fastened her fingers around the corner of the wall.
"Can you hang on?"
Mutely, Marcia nodded.
"I think so."
Taking the woman's other hand, Laws stepped gingerly onto the stairs. Step by step, he descended, still holding on to Marcia's hand. When he had gone as far as possible, he squatted down and reached for Hamilton.
"Can you get hold?"
he grunted. Hamilton, without turning around, held his arm back and stretched with all his strength. He could not see Bill Laws, but he could sense him there, could hear the harsh, rapid breathing of the Negro as he sat perched above him, trying to get hold of his groping fingers.
"No dice,"
Laws said dispassionately.
You're down too far.
Giving up, Hamilton pulled his aching arm back and settled down on the step.
Wait where you are,
Laws said.
I'll be back.
With a series of crashing noises, he bolted back up the stairs to the hallway, dragged Marcia with him, and was gone. When he returned, he had David Pritchett with him.
Take hold of Mrs. Hamilton's hand,
he instructed the boy.
Don't ask questions, do as I say.
Gripping the corner of the wall at the top of the stairs, Marcia closed her fingers around the boy's small hand. Laws herded the boy down the stairs as far as he could go, then taking hold of David's other hand, he himself descended.
Here I come,
he grunted.
You ready, Jack?
Clutching at the railing, Hamilton extended his other hand into the invisibility behind him. Laws's harsh breathing sounded nearby. Now he could feel the stairs quake as Laws came lower and lower. Then, incredibly, Laws's hard, sweat-slippery hand closed around his own. With a furious tug, Laws wrenched him loose from his position at the railing and forcibly dragged him up the stairs. Panting, gasping, Hamilton and Laws sprawled into the cheery hallway. David scrambled off in fright. Marcia, climbing unsteadily to her feet, reached quickly to take hold of her trembling husband.
What happened?
Laws demanded when he could talk.
What was going on down there?
I could hardly speak. I couldn't get back up, no matter which way I turned.
After a minute, he added,
both ways were down.
There's something down there, Laws said. I saw it.
Hamilton nodded.
She was waiting for me.
She?
That's where I left her. She was on the stairs when Edith Pritchett abolished her.
Marcia moaned sharply.
He means the waitress.
She's back, Hamilton said methodically. But she's not a waitress. Not in this world.
We can board up the stairwell,
Laws suggested.
Yes, Hamilton agreed. Board it up. Close her off, so she can't get me.
We will,
Laws assured him. Both he and Marcia hung tightly onto Hamilton as he stood staring back down into the gloomy, web-ridden depths of the stairwell.
We'll board it up. We won't let her get you.